The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 101, recorded Friday, November 15th, 2013. Fair Use and Access, the Shutdown Edition.
Welcome, everyone, to the second century of the Digital Campus podcast. Second century because it is, in fact, episode number 101. Who would have ever thought we'd make it this far? We are joined today by Amanda French, one of our podcast regulars. Amanda, where are you and how are you?
I am in my office, Mills, and I am doing just fine.
Well, that's good. And also Stephen Robertson. Stephen, where and how are you?
I'm afraid I'm in my office as well, but it has now got books in it, and it will soon have things on the wall. So it actually is much more like my office and a bit less like an empty space or the shell of Dan's office.
Now, so does that mean that the shipping container made its way from Taipei to the US?
It did, and it dodged the government shutdown. There were some issues with the unpacking by the movers, but it's all in the past now. So once things are on the walls, it'll all be done.
Well, so you're stuck here now with all your stuff. That's good. That means you can't just flip back to Australia. And I am Mills Kelly, and I am actually in my office too. So for a change, the podcasters are in their offices at George Mason University, two at the Center for History and New Media, and me over in the luxurious Robinson Hall, ready to fall down at any moment. We are also joined today by two of our fabulous graduate student assistants at the Center for History and New Media, Spencer Roberts and Ann McDivitt. Thanks, guys, for being here. They're going to help us as our grad students are doing these days with the post-production work. And so if you hear voices that you don't recognize chiming up from the background, that would either be Spencer or Anne. It's a real shame that Dan can't join us today. He's apparently on his way to the airport, and also that Tom can't join us because Tom now is tenured at the University of
Florida. He cannot join us because he's tenured, yes.
He
that makes total sense.
For those of you who work in higher education, you'll realize immediately why that would be, because the minute you get tenured, you get assigned to 8 more committees. It's like a little bonus package that you get. And so Tom is in some wonderful committee meeting talking about something really central to the fate of the University of Connecticut. And so he can't join us as well. But it's a real pity that they can't join us, because possibly the biggest story in the history of the Digital Campus podcast has occurred this week. And that is the decision in the Google Books settlement. I think it's possible that we may have discussed this in our very first episode of Digital Campus. If we didn't discuss it in the first episode, we have certainly beaten it to death over the last 6.5 years. And there's no other topic that we have discussed more. I feel like I know Judge Chin personally at this point. We've talked about the Google Books lawsuit so many times, and Dan, who is really our most expert person on this, is just going to have to hope we do a good job. Amanda, what do you think about the settlement? What do you think about the decision from Judge Chin?
Well, you know, I read the entire decision, and at some point it just struck me as a little peculiar. I never imagined that I would be the kind of person who would grow up into someone who would read avidly a major court decision like this. You know, it's like, the white paper, where is it? You know, where is this decision? I want to read it very closely. So it's obviously a major victory for the forces of good, if you consider the forces of good to be librarians, educators, digital humanities scholars who want to data mine this kind of thing. You know, even Google. Google has its moments, but of proto evil, perhaps. But the decision outlines very clearly, you know, all of the ways in which the Google Books search engine basically is a public good, even though Google as a commercial entity is presumably deriving some benefit from it. One of the interesting things that I noticed in the decision is that it really does rest so much on the fact that when you go to books.google.com, it is an amazing search engine that really helps you find all kinds of amazing things. And although there is a very specific breakdown of the four factors of fair use in the decision, I was really struck by the extent to which sort of the cultural practices around Google Books that have developed over the course of the lawsuit, right? I mean, this lawsuit has been going on for, you know, over 8 years. I think it's close to 9. And it's funny because it's like, well, if they could have decided this in 2005 just on the four-factor issue, it probably would have come out about the same. And yet, by now, you know, the mere fact of Google Books being so, so useful is one of the things that sort of was emphasized in the decision. So he said, well, you know, librarians use it to discover what books to buy. He said, you know, Google Books is part of the information literacy curriculum for students now. So, you know, in a way, I was struck by that, you know, just the fact that practices over the course of the last 8 or 9 years were really part of what informs this decision. And then one just final comment. I mean, I think we've been saying on the podcast for a few times how sad it is that the various peregrinations of the lawsuit have gotten away from that issue of what is fair use and is this kind of thing fair use. And so it's just really great to see it go back to that. There was a whole thing where, you know, does the Authors Guild have the right to be a class? And Judge Chin said, yes, they do, in fact. And then that decision was vacated. And they, you know, partly because they said, look, you have to decide this case on the merits of whether or not this, you know, scanning these books for the purpose of creating a digital index is fair use. And that, you know, the question of whether the Authors Guild is a class kind of depends a lot on that. So I you know, it's a victory for fair use. Apparently the Authors Guild is going to appeal, but I think this decision is so well written and so, you know, comes out so strongly in favor of it's being an obvious fair use and an obvious social good that I think it's unlikely that the appeal will succeed.
Yeah, I can imagine Judge Chin sitting and writing this decision and thinking, okay, this has to be the best written decision of my entire career so that I don't have to spend the next 8 years dealing with issues around the appeal.
It's beautifully written.
The Authors Guild has already said so, but I you know, I agree with you, Amanda. I think the thing that really struck me when I read the decision was how the original issues are what decided the case. And the original issues were about where the boundary between fair use and not fair use is. And I think it's really striking that that's what finally the judge based the decision on. But I also think it's, you know, as I was reading it, I was wondering, though, that there's this thing about the way you could read it another way and say, okay, Google Books has become so big that it's become a public good, and, you know, 20 million books, that makes it a public good. And so is the lesson for companies in the digital space that they, you know, that if they're just big enough, then they can push the boundaries of fair use and copyright in a direction that's favorable to them. What do you think about that?
I mean, yeah, I you know, the, as you said, this was very much a fair use case, but it struck me as thinking, you know, well, if the Authors Guild had gotten an injunction, basically, against Google Books for putting up any of the copyrighted works, then, you know, Google Books might not have been, have become as useful as it is, right? Because it would have been only an index to out-of-copyright works, which would have in itself been very useful, but not as useful as it is. But because, you know, for whatever reason, they didn't or couldn't get Google to just take down every single copyrighted or potentially copyrighted book that they had scanned, they could only do it on, you know, a case at a time. You know, I am the copyright owner of this book, Ball 4, and then you have to take that one out. Well, that doesn't really affect the usefulness of the search engine. But yeah, you may be right, Mills, that, that I mean, a lot of this may be a lesson that if you just, you know, go ahead and do it and make something really useful, then you'll be okay.
Well, and yeah, Stephen, what do you think about this?
I was just struck by how much the context around this has changed, though. I mean, in some ways, you know, trying to think back to 2004, that there was something totally inconceivable about Google Books. And, you know, certainly one of the ways to read the decision is you know, the sense in which Google Books is so much part of a broader landscape that, you know, that it seems somehow inevitable now in a way that it didn't in 2004. You know, and one of the things I really like about the decision in some ways is the way that it lays out all of the, you know, all of the things that you can do with something like Google Books, again, in a way that I'm not sure could have been done in 2004, you know. So, and, you know, and there that word is, you know, the word that kept running through it is transformative. You know, the standard has to be sort of transformative. And there's all sorts of ways in which, you know, the Google Books has been transformative in a way that makes this decision somehow seem, you know, aside from all of the issues that, that are still going on, it, you know, put into kind of the context of what we're used to being able to do online now, you know, it's hard to imagine Google Books not being there. And in that sense, you know, hard to actually, you know, take seriously the possibility in those terms that the decision couldn't have gone any other way. I mean, you know, this is the world of Google Books now, and in some ways this just confirms it.
Yeah. You know, I keep thinking a little bit about MOOCs, actually, weirdly enough, in relation to this, because I think I may disagree just a little bit with you, Stephen, in the sense of, you know, that this seemed inconceivable in 2004. I feel like in 2004, a lot of people had been, you know, like libraries in general, had been making noises for a long time about getting books online, and there certainly had been a lot of digitization projects and all of that. But of course, Google comes in. What's that?
The scale
and the speed and the fact that it, you know, was not on an institution by institution basis, right? So, you know, a lot of people kind of said when the Google Books project first started, you know, why can't libraries all just get together and do this? And, you know, one of the reasons is, well, they don't have the hardware expertise, you know, that Google, you know, invented a whole lot of new scanning technology in order to be able to do this. And they did all these kinds of efficiency studies and everything. But I think, you know, MOOCs are a little bit the same way, where it's like there's all of these individual institutional projects for, you know, delivering online education. But then these, you know, outside companies, Coursera and so on, have said, well, we can come up with one cross-institutional, more technologically advanced solution for this. And, you know, so I'm kind of wondering, like, I think there will be lawsuits related to the MOOCs. I have no doubt about that. The big lawsuit has not come out yet, but there will be one. I think that's inevitable. So it'll be interesting to see whether in 8 years, you know, the MOOCification of higher education will come to seem as inevitable as you say, Stephen, Google Books seems now.
Well, especially because, you know, so much of the content delivered in MOOCs is delivered in video lecture form. And so you could imagine Google or some other company creating a process for building a database, aggregating all of that information together and providing, and this is the key, snippets of those videos.
Oh, yeah.
And which would then make the content searchable because they could transcribe the audio. And you know, you can imagine Coursera and Udacity and all these other companies and universities as well you know, screaming and gnashing their teeth and pulling their hair out, and some enterprising attorney saying, ah, but you see, this is no different from the Google Book settlement, and we're just providing snippets.
That's so depressing.
So, you know, who would have ever thought that snippet would become such an important legal matter? But I think this is a case that could well go all the way up to the Supreme Court, and or at least, you know, be put in front of the justices for the possibility of hearing whether they'll hear it or not. It's another story. But when it does, I think it'll be intriguing to see either what their opinion is in refusing to hear the case or their opinion on the case, because there's the irony of a large corporation, Google, pushing the boundaries of fair use. And you know, so is the Supreme Court more likely to rule in favor of the copyright holders, the Authors Guild, or in favor of a large corporation that is pushing open access to snippets anyway? So I think it's going to be intriguing to see how the appeals play out. I hope for Judge Chin's sake, that's a little harder to say, that somebody else has to hear all of those appeals, because it's time for poor Judge Chin to move on to something else. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on that one?
Well, I disagree, Bills. I actually think the appeal will be denied, but that's probably, you know, that may be wishful thinking on my part, but I...
Yeah, but you can appeal the denial of the appeal, right?
Well, I don't know, Mills. I would not take any legal advice from me if I were you.
Or me either. So this, Dan, Tom, if you're listening out there, I'm sure this will not be the last time that we discuss this matter. So although you couldn't be here with us today, and I'm sure you would have had more to say about it, you'll have your chance. So now we're going to return to something, a story that's in the same general part of the world, digital world, and that is the question of digital first sale. Amanda, you want to explain what digital first sale is, and then talk a little bit about the input requested from the Department of Commerce on this issue?
Sure, yes. So the first sale doctrine, and I must say I'm not really clear what establishes this first sale doctrine, but I know what it is. First sale doctrine is the I guess legal principle that the first sale need not be the final one. So the obvious example is I buy a book, I read that book, and then I can resell that book. I need not, you know, the first sale doesn't have to be the only one. Now, in the digital age, it gets a bit more complicated because fundamentally the first sale usually is the last sale, because trying to resell a digital file falls under copyright in a way that selling a physical book doesn't. You know, when you have a physical book, the content and the actual object are separate. You're not allowed to copy the content and reproduce that, but you can sell the physical book. In the digital age, those concepts are sort of collapsed. So, recently, the U.S. Department of Commerce has called for public comment on whether the first sale doctrine should apply to ebooks and other digital files, including things like MP3s. So I think they've extended the deadline because of the government shutdown, which I think we're going to talk a little bit about as well. So you can submit comment on whether or not you believe that first sale doctrine should apply to digital files up until the first week in December or so, or December 12th, actually. So what's interesting about this is that, for obvious reasons, this would entail an entire revision of copyright law, which people have been calling for, right? So really the Department of Commerce is saying we actually really kind of need to take a look at copyright law in conjunction with this first sale doctrine. So it could lead to wholesale revisions of copyright law. We'll have to see.
And do you understand how the first sale doctrine applies to remixed content?
I do not.
Because it also has something to do with that. And we may have to ask our listeners to weigh in the comment field. But my understanding, and again, don't take legal advice from me, but my understanding is that digital first sale also has a doctrine that you refer to has force over the reusing of material to make remixes, and in particular, this has to do with music files, and in the way that, you know, bits and pieces of music are remixed together, and so then resold.
Well, I know that that's a lot of that is controlled by copyright law as well, but I'd never heard of first sale really affecting that. But I do know that. Bruce Willis made this a big issue. He was talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, he's bought all of this digital music and now he can't bequeath it to his children. Probably, right? You know, I mean, well,
thank God Bruce Willis is on this for us.
This is probably why the Department of Commerce is addressing this issue. They don't say so, but, you know, people like Bruce Willis making a stink about it, and it's going to get some attention. So, you know, there's, again, it's a little... I don't know. It's a little weird to be so activist just because of the internet for me. I don't feel naturally like a sort of a politically activist type of person, but I get very worked up about things like copyright in the digital age and first sale in the digital age and anything that's going to make, you know, digital culture spread farther tends to be something that I'm in favor of. So,
yeah, me as well. And I think that... you know, I'm sympathetic to the lawyers who are having and the government officials and others having to grapple with this because copyright has become such a moving target in the digital world just because it's so easy to manipulate and move things. I mean, part of the lawsuits around first sale had to do with, you know, if you have a text and you decide to email it to somebody, well, as soon as you decide to email it, you've made a copy because you've passed it on, but your email system is sending along a copy, so you've, in a sense, created a new item.
Right.
And is that a violation of copyright? Well, it could be. And so it is just such a moving target. Stephen, you come from the Australian context. How do folks in Australia view the copyright issues? Is Australian copyright law substantially different from American law?
None. Well, I really don't know enough to know, but no, I would say not in some of these core issues, certainly not in the sense which I think is the bottom line that you just described, which is the moving target element of what's going on here, that the cod law is making no real progress in keeping up with what we've got. But it's not, you know, there's not as much litigation around this in Australia, so it's not played out in quite the same, you know, public way. So, you know, if you're institutionally based in Australia, you'll occasionally get some sort of dictate from the officers responsible telling you how they're interpreting what's going on, but it's not anywhere near as invasive. It's the George Estate issue that we grapple with more, the e-reserve issue, and you know, Australia's moved into a similar environment where putting within e-reserve has become, you know, a practice that our institutions won't support any longer. But otherwise, it's just not playing out in anywhere near as prominent a way in Australia.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it's a crucial issue in education, in higher education, secondary education, but also the other aspects of education that we talk about a lot on the podcast, you know, museums, libraries, historic sites, and others that engage in educational activities, because where that copyright target lands is going to be really important for them in terms of what they use and don't use. And also, educational institutions, whatever they may be, tend to be pretty risk averse when it comes to things like violating copyright. And so we often, as educators, experience this sort of chilling effect from that risk aversion. Oh, no, you can't do that because it's against the law. I'm a big fan of saying, really, show me that law.
Right.
Is that so? We also get that as, you know, you coming from the financial aid office here on campus. Oh, you can't do that. It violates federal financial aid regulations. Really? Can I see those regulations? It's always a great question to ask. Can I see those regulations?
Well, you know, this first sale thing, you know, it has a very specific effect on higher education because, of course, for the last however many years, at least 50 or more than that, the way it has worked at universities is that you buy these really expensive textbooks, these print textbooks, and then when you're done with the semester, you sell them back, right? So there's a secondary market in textbooks. And then with the move to digital, That's certainly less possible just for people who are, you know, buying expensive textbooks, because the digital textbooks are at least, not that there are that many, you know, digital-only textbooks these days. And I just wanted to mention that a sort of a related story that we didn't agree to talk about, but which I found really interesting this last week, was the introduction of a bill by Al Franken and some other senator, whose name I forget, to create a program that would make open online textbooks. They would do a grant program for producing these open online textbooks and just make that, you know, sort of standard practice. And that seems like a really great idea to me. And, you know, once you have the textbook that doesn't cost anything, then certainly the need for this secondary market in physical textbooks kind of goes away. But that for sale doctrine is sort of a key thing that makes the very expensive textbooks for a college education a little bit more affordable, because you can sell them back.
Right. You know, and on the Franken bill, when I looked at that, I thought, okay, that's a great idea, and I'm really in favor of it. But you know, one of the things we experience at any digital humanities center like ours is that you get money to create something, but you don't get money to update it.
Right.
And of course, textbooks have to be updated constantly with new knowledge. And so I wondered when I saw that, okay, are they also going to provide the money for this sort of constant updating of the books? Because this is, of course, you know, for all of the problems with the price of textbooks, one of the things that the money from that price does pay for is new editions and you know, mm-hmm. rewrites. And so I'm not exactly clear how they would propose to continue to pay for that. And which raises the issue of the government support for the work that we do. And those of us who live in the Washington area were especially aware of the closing of most federal government offices. But that closing, of course, rippled out through the entire country. And for scholars, this was an important problem, because websites that we've come to depend on, like the Catalog of the Library of Congress or access to material in the National Archives, these sites went down during the government shutdown. What do you guys think about that? I mean, is this something that's unacceptable? Is it just a reality of the world that we live in? Is it, you know, what do we make of this?
Well, I thought, you know, the shutdown was an embarrassment and a horror. You know, there's no doubt about that.
Things, yeah.
You know, I, Stephen, again, will appeal to you as someone coming from outside the country. We apologize for our country. It was a big mess. But,
I can hear our grad students giggling in the background.
Grad students were also mad.
Grad students were mad. Tell us about your madness.
Well, one of my big issues was that I had an assignment that was due for a cartography course, and we had to rely on government websites to come up with the rubber sheeting. And, couldn't access any of them. Couldn't do the project. That's fun. I missed out on an entire section of the course that I thought was really, really cool because they couldn't agree on how to make the government work. That's good.
I mean, I kind of hope that there were a few more people who experienced that, because, you know, there are a few anecdotal stories like that about, you know, people who had, you know, government websites hardwired into teaching experiences, and, you know, their disappearance at least, you know, has the value of reminding people where they come from. And what they do. But there is something interesting about shutting down a website, and, you know, as part of a shutdown of kind of, you know, the ongoing, you know, work of government agencies, because, you know, there's a lot of static content on websites, you know, and I think that there is at some level an expectation that they're the kind of thing that just keep on going. I mean, it's a version of you know, what's missing from the Franken textbook bill, the sense that you build the website and you leave it up there and you never have to worry about it again.
Right.
So the fact that, you know, that the decision was made to actually connect directly, you know, the online presence and the online work of government agencies with the people who do it, I think, you know, I think maybe it draws a little bit more attention to the work of people who create online content and make people aware that it's there, as well as, you know, just generally to the sense that the stuff does connect to the government in various ways. But you know, in some ways, it's against our increasing sense of the automatic that to take down websites as if they're connected to people, and if the people aren't there, the website can't be there.
Yeah, it was that's the only thing, is that it was specifically left up to each individual agency to decide who was accepted and not accepted from the general furlough that took place. And I think, you know, it's not a criticism to admit that some of those agencies deliberately decided to shut down websites that they probably could have kept running. And that their decision to do that was specifically in order to draw attention to, hey, there's this valuable stuff here that you're accustomed to getting on a regular basis that you can't get when people are furloughed. So, you know,
But I think what's interesting about that is, you know, to send a message about what the government does. We're at a moment where, you know, one of the ways to do that strategically is to sort of, you know, shut down a website.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, close a memorial, which, you know, is the other kind of iconic marker of that. I mean, there's a certainly irony against the backdrop of the online problems of Obamacare, where they can't get the government websites up. That they've also
They can't get it to work in the first place.
I stopped listening to all that coverage because it's so depressing. I was, you know, listening to it for quite a while and reading about it, and I can't deal with it anymore.
I change the channel every time now.
Yeah.
But you know, it is... So, for instance, I would be... Somebody who listens to the podcast who works at the Library of Congress, I would be really interested to know, did the Library of Congress essentially close its doors? Because it is the Library of Congress. It is not the Library of the American People. It is secondarily the Library of the American People, but it is first and foremost the Library of Congress, and exists to serve the needs of the Congress. So were congressional staffers also unable to access the physical collection? That would be interesting to know, because I don't remember seeing any news coverage about that.
I could be wrong. I have the impression that they did close the Library of Congress, and in fact, they also shut down some APIs, which some Omeka technologies rely on. So there's a Library of Congress subject heading plugin for Omeka, which draws on some terrific data APIs that the Library of Congress provides, which were not functional for a little while. And there was some discussion about like how to prevent this kind of reliance on these, you know, Library of Congress technologies in the future. Can we back them up somewhere? All of that. But my impression is that actually they did keep a skeleton staff on to, you know, do research for Congress members and congressional aides, to the extent that they were still around.
So I'm just sitting here thinking of the irony of how our conversation started this afternoon, because we started with that Google Books had become so large that it had become a public good, and here we're talking about another public good, the Library of Congress, which, because of the paralysis in our political system, was you know, suddenly ceased to be a public good for a little while, and so that's just, you know, the whole thing was as annoying as possible, as you could possibly imagine, but you know, of course, we're also, it's worth remembering, talking about the annoying parts of all of this, as opposed to the sort of real impact of people losing jobs and not getting paid and things like that. But it does raise the issue of things, you know, the example that you give, Amanda, about not being able to access that data API. That's a real problem for software developers, especially in, you know, in our area of work, you know, in academia and public history and things like that. So we are going to have to, you know, if we're entering into a long-term period of this kind of paralysis, we'll have to think of other kinds of solutions. Turning to another government or quasi-government agency, the Smithsonian, just up the road, has apparently gone all in on 3D. Stephen, you want to tell us about the Smithsonian's 3D imaging projects?
Yeah, absolutely. So Wednesday, the Smithsonian launched its 3D online viewer with a great pizzazz. And it is interesting in the sense that it's in the context of a really, you know, all-in move to 3D, beginning with a whole range of their 3D artifacts from, the, you know, the Wright Flyer aircraft to Chinese Buddhas to woolly mammoth fossils, but also an ongoing commitment to 3D digitization that it extends to beyond building a 3D collection, all the way into the idea that they're going to attach that to kind of augmented reality and bring 3D into the museums, or at the very least bring a maker lab into the museums. And certainly the rhetoric of the story is very reminiscent of sort of document digitization. This is the sort of, you know, the artifact version of that, and in some ways the museum's version of what libraries and archives have already gone through. But the imperative here is also interestingly educational. This is about pushing objects out into the classrooms to establish the relevance of the museums. And of course, there the impetus is to connect up to the new accessibility of 3D printers. And there's a sort of, you know, return to materiality in what they're doing here with 3D as well. They're creating these, you know, virtual images of their artifacts, but they're doing so partly at least so that people can, you know, reproduce them in a material form via 3D printers. And in that sense, there's a, you know, my first reaction was to sort of the language of sort of seeing and touching and making accessible, which online 3D obviously doesn't, but it is a bridge actually to putting some version of these objects into people's hands, though the rhetoric does make that sound a little bit easier than it is. You know, the notion that within minutes a 3D printer is going to reproduce something belies the experience with the 3D printer we have in the centre in terms of just how long it can take to produce an interesting 3D image. But, you know, so I'm sort of torn here between a sense that there's a little bit of fetishizing about how close 3D does bring objects to you, with a sense that via the 3D printer this is a kind of bridge to putting material objects and into people's hands. And it ties up with another story that we had bouncing around to talk about, which is about sort of taking 3D outside the museum and recreating spaces. And so there's an organization called SciArc that wants to go around preserving, you know, the 500 most important heritage sites around the world, to actually, and there it's a clearer sense of preservation, but they're also looking to push these out into educational realms to create spaces that people can experience as well as objects. So I think that, you know, the moment for 3D is clearly, you know, well and truly upon us, and this is about the greater accessibility of 3D printers and the ability of other 3D technology to be usable in ways, though the Smithsonian does want $15 million to build itself a new 3D lab right on the mall, so it's not that accessible, but nonetheless this is a technology that is clearly moving into people's hands. And I guess my one reservation about this is, you know, and this comes very much from thinking about where 3D is connected to my own digital work, which is on Harlem and on places and neighborhoods. And when I show people maps of Harlem, I invariably get people who want assume that the thing is to build a 3D Harlem. I've always been a little wary of just what 3D would add to places, and I guess particularly with what SciArc's doing, but even in terms of objects, I'm a little wary of the kind of absence of people in 3D. So you can rotate all of these items around, but the artifacts in isolation without people and context, and I do wonder whether that does limit some sense of what's going on there. I can hear myself.
Yeah, that's the 3D audio.
Yeah, that was 3D. That's what I was thinking. 3D audio. Well, you know, I'm fortunate enough 2 weeks ago now to visit the Think Lab at the University of Mary Washington, our sister campus, partner campus, part of the state university system just down the road from us, and where, you know, they just done some really cool stuff there. They've got a couple of 3D printers and a sewing table and a Dremel table and you know, walls painted with whiteboard paint, and so just all kinds of interesting stuff going on there. And it, one of the things that they showed me was that there's a hack for the Xbox Kinect that allows you to just take the handheld controller and use it as a 3D scanner, And so they had Tim, who's the, I'm sorry, I can't remember Tim's last name all of a sudden, who's the director of the Think Lab. The students scanned him with this and then produced a 3D, essentially a, you know, like a bust like you would have in a museum of him, and just using that. And so so the possibilities for the kinds of things that Stephen's talking about getting outside and scanning larger objects and producing 3D models from them, or 3D reproductions, you know, it's the price is going down.
I was going to say that's what's the most important thing. Because with some of these, I just, it's not that it's not cool, but I just always think about return on investment. Like, is the learning really that much greater with 3D than it is with 2D? And it depends on what you're putting in 3D. But it's certainly true that it's just a lot more technically difficult and therefore more expensive to get it done.
But. Yeah, I mean, so it is still very expensive, and you know, the digital divide on that is pretty broad. But I think, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, clearly the price is going to be a lot lower. You know, if we just look at the price drop in tablet computing, for instance, you know, I think that's probably a good marker for that. The difference, of course, is that you're still going to have supply chains for things like the plastic used in the extruders, but also, as Stephen points out, you know, you watch the video of 3D printers working, boy, they produce those objects really fast, and then you watch them in the real world, and it takes a long time.
So, yes, it does.
It requires a great deal of patience. But I think they'll speed up as well. So I think that, you know, just the fact that a big cultural heritage institution like the Smithsonian has made this decision, I think is going to be really important going forward, because, you know, to me, the coolness factor in that is that they're imagining what the world's going to be like in 4 or 5 years when 3D printers are accessible to a much larger audience. Of purchasers, and so at that point, those people will be able to reproduce objects that from the Smithsonian collection. People who couldn't easily get to Washington to see those things, or don't want to just look at the, you know, the flat 2D image on their computer screen. So I think that's going to be pretty cool. The final story for today is one that I'm not even sure why this is news, but we thought we would just raise it as a little interesting, in case you were worried, story. For those of you who teach, if you are concerned about whether or not your students use their digital devices to do non-class related things during your class, you can stop worrying about that, because someone has done a research study. Let's see, Barney McCoy, associate professor of broadcasting at the University of Nebraska Lincoln, conducted a study to show, and I know this is going to shock everyone, but 90% of the students who he surveyed said that they used their digital devices to do non-class related things in during the course of you know, a day's lecture or whatever. And I know that's going to be a shock to everyone out there. And I'm really glad that
I'm shocked it's not 95%, Mills.
You know, well, yeah, there's probably a margin of error in there somewhere, but 8% say that they never do. And if we discount that and say that half of those 8% are lying, then we get to a man is 95%. So, you know, and 15% say that more than 30 times during class. Now, is this an argument for banning all electronic devices from class? Well, I don't think so, because if you read the comments on the Inside Higher Ed story on this, several people say, let's all raise our hands if we've never used a digital device in a faculty meeting to check our email or to look at pictures of our grandchildren or whatever it might be. And so I think we're all a little guilty on this. And as an experienced teacher, I just have one prescription for those who are worried about students texting in class or Facebooking or whatever. And it's pretty simple, actually. It's don't be boring.
Don't be boring.
Maybe give them something else to do related to the class with their devices. I mean, I think, you know, that's part of what's going on there. You know, there's a whole lot of class-related things that they could be doing that would, you know, engage that part of their brains. Because, you know, I agree. I think the people with the willpower and the kind of relationship to the world not to be connected through their devices and, you know, quote-unquote multitasking, even if they're not actually achieving anything, I think that, you know, doesn't exist. You know, doing that is part and parcel of our world. And I think maybe when we're teaching students, we have to actually recognize that they have that at their fingertips. And if we're not going to give them something to do with it, they're going to do something else with it.
Yeah. I actually think that, weirdly enough, this comes back to MOOCs for me.
It's all about MOOCs.
So I go to a lot of that camps, obviously, right? And the sort of default that camp session is actually a lot like a seminar. And it's tends to be small, you know. It's not 20 people in a committee meeting trying to figure out what to do, and there's a few people who don't really care about what to do, and therefore they're checking their email or whatever, or they're just not checked into the discussion. It's usually, you know, 10 or 15 people, 10 or a dozen people who are really invested in whatever the topic is that they're talking about. And I mean, I maybe, you know, it's my favorite way to teach, and it's my favorite kind of class to be in is the small seminar. And I notice that people are really engaged in those kinds of seminars where it really is just a really good conversation. And then again, yeah, if you're a really good seminar facilitator, which I am not always, but you know, have a lot of experience with at least, yeah, you can make it interesting, and it's a really good, interesting conversation, and people don't want to check out as much, I think. However, it almost doesn't matter how good a lecturer you are. If you're lecturing, even if you're being extremely gripping, people will be texting. They might be, you know, tweeting about how awesome you are. So it's not necessarily the case that people are just not going to text if you're being interesting. It's more about, you know, are they going to be engaged or not?
Right.
And I do, you know, so yes, when you're lecturing, you should try to be as interesting as possible. But ideally, I think the ideal kind of educational system for me is an in-person, small, seminar-like class. And so the way it relates to MOOCs for me is that with MOOCs, you know, or any kind of online education, you know, it doesn't matter. You can be multitasking, right, during the video that you're watching or whatever. But there are also little forum discussion type things, I guess, in MOOCs where you can have some bastardized version of the small seminar thing. So, you know, the ideal is to have a small engaged group of people, I think.
I think you are absolutely right. And if only we could figure out how to make the economics of higher education work so that all classes were that size, then it would be awesome. Unfortunately, we're not there yet, but we're trying to think about ways to do it. And, you know, one possibility is to move those large lectures into video format, because my view is if you're going to watch a large lecture, you might as well watch it in your pajamas on your couch rather than sitting in a classroom with 299 other people who may or may not be paying attention. So, because if you can't ask questions, what's the point of being there? I know everybody is, you know, shocked and disappointed to find out that 90% of their students occasionally don't pay attention and occasionally wander off into the digital world. But I think we'll all figure out a way to persevere. So thank you all very much for listening today. Thanks, Amanda. Thanks, Stephen and Anne and Spencer back there in the background. And Dan and Tom, we will give you your chance to talk about Google Books. We promise.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.